If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
I think if, you know, if you have a three-year business plan, get a five-year loan with a prepay, so you got a little with flexibility in your prepay, so you got a little margin for error, so you're not going right up against it, but you don't need to saddle yourself with a large prepayment penalty like the next buyer.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Michael Becker is a principal at SBI Advisory LLC and heads SBI's Dallas, Texas office, where he oversees all aspects of property operations, including asset management, property management oversight, accounting and taxation, capital improvement and renovation projects, and investor relations. Michael is a 15-year veteran commercial real estate banker and has originated and managed numerous portfolios of permanent and bridge loans in all major asset classes. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine. I mean, you've got an amazing background. I mean, you've done it all. So, you know, the same questions I ask everybody, though, if you can just briefly tell us, you know, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how'd you get there?
Yeah, as you kind of read in my bio, my professional background's in commercial real estate lending. So I was a longtime banker, lent on all the major income producing asset classes of commercial real estate. And last part of my banking career just really focused on multifamily lending. And kind of through that process, just realized on the wrong side of all those deals. Kind of better be the borrower than the lender. And started out a little bit over a decade ago doing some smaller stuff, kind of my own money, so, you know, little rent houses and things like that. And kind of through that process, realized I wasn't very scalable. So transitioned in 2013, bought our first larger scale multifamily deal by syndication. And, you know, here we are almost 60 deals later, you know, 11, 12,000 units later. We own about 6,700 in the portfolio today, worth over $1 billion. Seems like 10 minutes ago, we were just kind of getting going, but here we are with a lot of stuff on our plates. It's been a really cool kind of run, and glad I'm not a banker anymore. That's for sure.
Right. I mean, good for you and I've often wondered that. You know, as brokers, you know, they bring all these deals, they help you underwrite them, they put all the information together, and you go, wait, do you guys not see what's happening on this side of the table? Or is it just that maybe the chase of the quick hit that they get from that commission check, just, it's like, oh, that's fun.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of them, obviously they see it, right? And see guys like me that are out there, you know, they're doing well, and we're crushing it. But, you know, it's just one thing to see it. It's another thing to go out and actually do it, right? I mean, you got to form the capital. You got to get debt. You got to get the equity. You got to take some risk along the way. It's not a layup on some of these deals. You got to actually deliver. And now the price of poker is so high with, you know, non-refundable earnest money and all the pursuit costs you got up front. So if you make a mistake, it's, you know, real money out of there. But, you know, a lot of the brokers, at least in markets I play in, they actually invest as LPs and with some of their better clients. So, you know, in the last deal we put out, I think we had 13 or 14 of the different brokers, either mortgage brokers or commercial real estate brokers in the area, actually invest into our last deal. So they're throwing money in the deals that they like. So it always makes me feel good when they do that, because those are the guys that see all the deals. So they kind of know the better ones from the lesser ones.
Right, right. So in 13, you said you've transacted on 11 or 12,000 units in the last 8 years, roughly.
Yep.
I mean, that's explosive growth and a lot of transaction volume. If you transact on 12,000 and you roughly hold 6,000 at this point, I mean, that's a lot of volume. And I guess, what do you see the state of the multifamily investment market today? And why do you not hold all 12,000 of them still?
Yeah, you know, wish we would have held a few more a little longer. You know, obviously, you know, we first started out, we started out doing a lot of workforce housing. So Texas, think like 1960s, 1970s, kind of for the year of construction. Then we transitioned, kind of did a lot of B class. So think kind of like 1980s to kind of the 1990s for year of construction. And then now kind of what the last, you know, 4 years, really, we've kind of transitioned to do A minus to A. So, you know, most everything we own is kind of 20 years or younger for kind of year of construction. And that's been kind of a function over largely what's been going on in the marketplace, where it used to be a bigger spread when I first started between the top of the grade and the bottom of the grade. So in Dallas, which is the market that we own most of our stuff in, you could have bought, when I got started, a brand new class A deal for about a 5 cap. A B deal would be about 6 to 6.5 cap, and a C deal would be 8 to 8.5. Fast forward today, like, it sounds crazy, you, these words come out of my mouth, but an A deal in Dallas Fort Worth is probably about a 375, a B deal is probably a 4, and a C deal is probably 4.25. And if you put some value out on some of these, it might even be a little bit lower of a cap rate. So people pay a little bit more for the opportunity to do the upside. So what used to be a 300 basis point, a 3% spread between the top of the grade and the bottom of the grade is, you know, they're virtually on top of each other. So it doesn't make as much sense to me right now to pay the same or similar cap rate for something built in 1974 that I can for something built in 2004 or 2014. I mean, they're all the same cap. I'd rather buy a little nicer if you have the ability to do it, which is kind of what is a little bit different when you're starting out. You know, these newer deals are expensive. So you got to front a lot of earnest money and raise a lot more capital and qualify for bigger loan amounts. And so it's hard to do that when you start. But, you know, yeah, if we could have, you know, we bought a bunch of 8 caps, we had a bunch of upside and income, and then, you know, rents grew on top of that. And then we sold them, you know, cap rates compressed to 6%. We sold them. I just didn't know cap rates going to go to 4%. Otherwise, I might have held a little bit longer. But I don't have too many regrets, though, because if I didn't sell that first deal, I wouldn't have the track record and ability by that 6th or 7th deal. And then, you know, just I try not to live in the rearview mirror, because doing that one thing then led to the next thing. And I might not have had this next thing if I didn't do that first thing, and, you know, so forth and so on. So no major regrets, but yeah, it would have been nice to figure out how to hold a couple of those. Cause, you know, we bought some of these for like 30,000, sold them for 55,000. And then, you know, the next guy sold them for 75,000. They're worth 100,000 today. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy what's happened in 8 years.
Right. Can you talk to us about the state of the market right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking to you from the view of a guy who participates in Texas. And so I live in Texas, and we own Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, and we're getting into San Antonio right now. So my lens of the world is kind of colored with those glasses of what the markets I participate in. So if you're in someone sitting in San Francisco who does business in San Francisco, New York, you probably have a different perspective than say my perspective. But to be blunt, it's never been as hot as it is right now in my time. And we've been in an up market the entire time I've owned real estate. I mean, it's the amount of capital that is coming into multifamily, specifically into Texas and the majors in Texas, is insatiable. It's like an obscene amount of money chasing a relatively small number of deals. And the pricing is, you know, accelerating in real time. Cap rates have compressed to, you know, levels that were on par with, you know, a lot of these historical numbers you'd see in California and in New York, and, you know, kind of in the threes. A lot of these deals are trading, I'd say the market cap rate in Dallas Fort Worth is probably 375, and the market cap rate in Austin is probably 3.5. For stabilized, nice deals, maybe if it's a dumpster fire deal, maybe it's a little bit different, but these nicer deals, and that's, you know, crazy to me to me that they're gotten that low. But I mean, there's just so much interest and demand, and it's a function of, you know, all the guys that have been here like myself for a while and done well. You know, we're still here, we're still trying to do deals. And then you get, and we've already had a lot of California money kind of come to our market, but now we're seeing more of it, and some stuff from the Northeast, which historically gone a little bit more to, like, you know, the Carolinas, Georgia, Florida, down in the Southeast, that's coming here a little bit more. And then you got people that would want an allocation in commercial real estate that might have spread it out between all the majors, but they're, you know, not doing hospitality, not doing retail, not doing office. So that money's now allocated to industrial multifamily. So we're seeing more of that. And then you're seeing some of these institutions that have kind of redlined a lot of the flyover states like Texas historically been perceived as. Now they want to get out of the gateway markets and come into Texas, Phoenix, Atlanta, Charlotte, you're in Tennessee, your backyard, right? So you're seeing more and more of that capital that historically hadn't been here. Now it's coming here, and it's just driving cap rates down and pricing up. So it's insatiable, the amount of demand. It's extremely liquid, and it's like, you know, it's great when you own a bunch of stuff, but it's a freaking knife fight out there trying to get anything to make sense and go out and try to fight these guys out to win some of these deals. So it's kind of a tale of two cities. The best of times and the worst of times are the same, depending if you're trying to buy or sell, really.
Right. What is a strategic way you guys compete?
Well, I have a lot of little sayings. One of the sayings I like to say, it's a completely unfair business. A lot of this is who you know, what you know, what chips you can trade. So if you're coming in Dallas, you know, good luck, right? You got to go bang it out with a guy like me that's been here for my entire life doing business for a really long time as a banker and now a principal in the space. And so I got well over a decade ahead of you going on golf trips and shooting stuff and going to the bar and drinking with these brokers and all that stuff that matters, you know. So you're gonna have to pay up, and you're gonna have to put, you know, some pretty material non refundable earnest money and be pretty aggressive on your terms. You know, me, I'm just trying to, you know, I think of it kind of one or two ways. When we try to look at everything. So we look at marketed deals and we look at off market deals. And so I'm always angling to get myself in a position where if it's an off market deal, I want to make sure I get the first call, you know, on it. So get the first opportunity to react. If I can move quicker than the next person, I got an advantage. Or if it's a marketed deal, I want to get the last call, right? I want to get that last piece of information so I can determine if I want to pay whatever price it takes to win that deal and do whatever term it takes to win that deal, and at least have that opportunity to do it. So that's what I'm always kind of angling. And we're just look at everything. So just about being in front of these guys, persistent, and then leveraging the great track record we have and reputation and honestly our friendship that we have with most of the community. So that's really what I'm trying to leverage on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How have you seen terms of, like, I think one of the things you mentioned there was non-refundable earnest money. Have you seen some other things change in the last 10 years, just as far as the way that deals are structured on the offer side?
Yeah, you know, that's the biggest thing is, you know, where you could get a financing contingency and a inspection contingency when we first started. That's gone, right? Like, you know, it's a portion, if not all, of the earnest money is non-refundable at execution of the contract. A lot of times we've never done a deal where we haven't had access to the properties while we negotiate the contracts. So usually we get a access agreement or able to kind of do a lease file audit, get them the critical diligence information and, you know, walk units and the roof and parking lot, stuff like that with the contractor. So that's usually what we do. But sometimes you're seeing these people waiving even that. So they literally are just going on just by touring the property, not having any sort of inspection, any sort of inspections before they go non-refundable. You know, you're just really tightening up every sort of term on, you know, survey and title review and making sure that's done while you do the contract and not have an environmental contingency. So you're making sure you get your phase one done while you're negotiating your escrow. I mean, there's just a lot, every term you can think of has been tightened down in the seller's favor along the way. And that's kind of what it's taking to remove the risk for the seller. So they like your offer over the next person's on, you know, on top of obviously the purchase price being, you know, critical on the economic terms.
Right. Do you see that changing in the future?
Yeah, that's only one thing that is certain is that everything that I'm telling you today will be a little different in the future. So it's always ebbing and flowing, and it seems to be going in the seller's favor for the better part of the last decade, with maybe a little, you know, moment in time here or there. Like if you had the stones and the ability to buy a deal in late March, April, May, maybe even to June of 2020, you could have had some more favorable terms. But once July came around, back to the seller's market. So if you had the guts to do a deal in that 3-month window when there was complete uncertainty, you probably were able to get something on the sellers. But as of right now, it's a complete seller's market. But, you know, 2-3 years, 4 years, 5 years, it's going to be different.
Right. That's fascinating. So you guys, I know we've talked about this early on, but you had mentioned that, hey, you know, you bought it at $30,000 a door, sold it for 50 or 60. The next guy sold it for 70 or 80. And the next guy's going to sell it for 100. Are you guys in a contractionary phase of your business, or are you guys still expanding?
No, I mean, I'm extremely bullish, right? So with all that said, I mean, you know, there's a reason why the prices have gone up. You know, part of it's cap rate compression, but, you know, a lot of it's our rental rates growth are materially higher. You know, the rents are just a lot higher than what they were when we were first buying deals. The market's got a lot more sophisticated, a lot more market participants, lots of podcasts out there, lots of people interested in the workforce housing space. And then institutionally, a lot more the kind of institutional people want to make sure they have exposure to this space as well. So just a ton of demand and money, and the debt terms are materially better today than what they were 8-10 years ago. I mean, so, you know, in every respect is better, except for, you know, the returns that just kind of drives your expected returns down as an investor in some of these deals. But there's good reason. And, you know, again, speaking to you from the view of a guy from Dallas, Fort Worth right now, I'm recording this as we talk, owning a bunch of property in Texas. I mean, I don't know what's stopping, because in real time right now, here we are kind of latter part of May, and we're seeing rental rate growth go through the roof, right? I mean, the rental rates are, you know, we're going to see 6-8% rent growth between Dallas, Fort Worth, and Austin in 2021. That's, and that I'm confident in that, because that's what we're seeing in real time my real lease rate outs, like as I'm talking to you for the last 90 days, you know, we're averaging six plus percent in trade outs across the board, old lease to new lease. So it's just, I don't see what stops it. And then you see the new supply, I mean, you hear all the lumber, labor, land, steel, copper, all the input costs to go build a new multifamily project are going up and up and up. So they're going to have to justify, you know, higher rents to justify building more and more product. Or if they can't justify these higher rents and the rents are there, then the new supply is going to pull back and it's going to make rents go up. So, you know, like I just don't see what stops it for the intermediate term. I mean, you know, if rates go up, maybe cap rates, interest rates go up, maybe cap rates expand. But if interest rates go up, it makes the home affordability even less affordable, and that'll make rents go up too. So I think we have a good 3 to 5 year run of seeing pretty material rental rate growth in the Texas markets that I participate in for sure. That's probably the same in Phoenix, Atlanta, you know, the Sun Belt markets that aren't, you know, California or places like that. I think we got the wind at our back for, you know, the near to intermediate term, you know, 3 to 5 years.
Right. Or even bring into account, you know, we've talked, kind of hinted at the potential for inflation, but all this money printing as well.
That's right. You know, another stat too, if you think, I read an article where it was amazing stat to me that recently that the young adult population age 18 to 29, 56% or something like that of the young adults in this country between age 18 to 29 still live at home with their parents. So all those people still haven't gone out in the real world and formed their own household. So that tells you the pent-up demand that'll be, you know, steadily feeding the market for the next decade, right? I mean, those people at some point are going to have to get out of mom's basement and go get their own place. And, you know, that's going to further support the demand in the future. So, I mean, I think there's only one way, and this is to be honest with you, and with inflation, with everything, I think it, you know, certainly is going to support, you know, ever increasing net operating income or rents at leasing. And we need it because labor is going up, insurance, taxes, you know, try to get an appliance to swap out an old appliance costs you a lot more. And if you can source it. And so, you know, our expenses are going up, but I think the income will outpace expenses for a change.
Right, right. No, that's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. What are some things, if you could give us one or two highlights over your last 8 to 10 years that you have done well that you should say the rest of us could emulate?
You know, I mean, I think what we do well, or what I think I do well, is I always kind of know where my North Compass is, right? So I try to make sure I'm focused on the main thing and what's the most critical part of my business. You know, I got a lot of responsibility and pressure. You know, we got, like I said, you know, almost 7,000 units in the portfolio today as we talk. So that means I got 14,000-15,000 residents live on one of my properties, right? And if you think about that, that's, you know, that makes you kind of pucker up a little bit. That's a lot of responsibility that I'm ultimately responsible for at the end of the day. You know, I'm kind of the guy where it stops. And then, you know, I got 1300, 1400 K1s in 2020, and, you know, I'm going to do more in 2021. So we got a lot of investors that invest a lot of money with us. And so we just got a lot of responsibility, you know, so, but, you know, with all that said, I got a lot of pressures on me, but at the end of the day, the way I drive revenue and make money in my business is, I, you know, it's just really two things. I got to find money and find deals. So I got to work with the brokers, find good opportunities. And then I got to work with my investors, kind of source new investors, and everything else is sort of noise. You know, it's all important. Got to do my tax returns, got to operate, execute the business plan, maintain my property, make sure it's, you know, safe, affordable, you know, housing is what I aim to go provide, got to communicate with all the lenders. But, you know, I need to get a lot of that stuff off my plate onto qualified team members. And I need to focus on finding money and finding deals. And that's really what makes the world go round. So if I get going down a rabbit hole on something that doesn't feed one of the greater two missions of my company and with what my highest species of my time is, I try to stop myself, get that task, put it on somebody else, and just get back to whatever the main mission, which is finding money and finding deals. So I think that's what I do pretty well, and I'm not perfect at it. And I certainly will go down a rabbit hole on something and burn an hour of my life that I wish I had back. But that's really what I always try to do, is snap myself and get back to it. Instead of wasting, you know, have a bad hour turn into a bad day, turn into a bad week, I just try to keep it at that bad hour and then get back to be productive.
Right. I love that. I love that. That's succinct and very clear. Very clear. If you could rewind the tape a little bit, and if there was something you could do or would do differently, is there anything you'd do differently?
Yeah. You know, the single biggest mistake we made, and I made it a few times, is when we first started going, you know, the debt market started loosening up quite a bit. You know, I started buying in 2013 and bought our first deal. And the preceding couple of years were pretty tough from, you know, trying to get equity. You know, operations were starting to improve. And, you know, but it wasn't that long after the Great Recession. And so, you know, what we did is we had these buildings that we bought, had 20% upside on rent. We can build back some utilities, get some other income, maybe reduce some expenses. And, you know, what our brilliant idea at the time was, we'd go out and get a 10-year fixed rate Fannie Mae mortgage. mortgage. The rates were really low at 5%, and you know, the market was loosening up, and we had a whole year of interest only, and it was great. And we thought that we'd go renovate it and sell the property when, you know, 3 years into it, and the buyer is going to come, the interest rates were going to go up, and a buyer is going to come assume our mortgage. And that loan would be an asset to us, it'd be accretive to our situation. And boy, was that wrong, right? I mean, it was the exact opposite happened. 5% went to 4%, went to 3%, and 1 year of interest only went to 3 years of interest only, went to 5 years of interest only. And that loan that we thought was going to be an asset was a liability, because these fixed rate mortgages have yield maintenance or defeasance prepay penalties. So we had these really large prepay penalties that, you know, ate into a portion of the net proceeds that we otherwise would have received if we just could have offered it without that loan. So, you know, we did really, really well in spite of that, but we would have absolutely, you know, just been over the moon if we didn't have to deal with some of these prepay penalties. So the takeaway really is making sure that you just match your maturity or match the loan to your business plan. Don't try to get cute like I did and thinking that would be, you know, accretive. I think if, you know, if you have a 3-year business plan, get a 5-year loan with the prepay. So you got a little with flexibility in your prepay. So you got a little margin for error. So you're not going right up against it, but you don't need to saddle yourself with a large prepayment penalty. Like the next buyer put their own type of loan and they might want to put a bridge loan on it. Maybe they want your type of loan, but let them decide that at that time. I think that was a single biggest mistake that costs, you know, us and our investors, you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars over the last several years with these prepayment penalties. I'm selling a deal here in a couple of weeks, and we, you know, we have a $6.5 million prepay that, and we're still going to sell it and make a bunch of money. But I mean, you know, it would, you know, it's just as a kid who grew up kind of poor, that's, I see your face, right? That makes you sick. It makes me sick, right? But it is what it is. And, you know, there's nothing we do. We can't go back in time and change that decision.
No, you can't. No, that makes me nauseous.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and good for you for still having the meat on the bone. I mean, the deal was bought, right? It was well executed, and you're probably going to still make a pile of money on it, but I don't care how much you make, leaving $6.5 million on the table. That's an expensive lesson you just shared with us. That's probably the most expensive lesson I've heard.
I've learned it real good, right? So, and then that's one deal. I mean, I would probably tally up, and we'd be north of $30 million, the amount of yield maintenance or lower purchase price we sold deals for to compensate for the yield maintenance of my 8 years. Like, no joke, it's been, and we absolutely crushed every deal in spite of that. So it would have been that much better.
Right. I mean, yeah, if you hit your returns to your investors and you guys still made money, you know, like you said, you don't want to spend too much time looking in the rearview mirror, but right. You need to learn from those. That's still, you still don't want to miss the lesson that was provided. So holy smokes, that's amazing. Michael, let's jump here into the final four. The first question is this: what is one single piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
You know, I mean, I think the biggest thing you need to do is when you get started is just kind of get real about where you sit. Completely unfair business. You know, a lot of it's who you know, what you know, what chips you can trade. And if you're starting out and you haven't done a deal, you're at a very distinct disadvantage to someone that's done, you know, 60 deals like me. So making sure that you know, understand what you bring to the table, and it's, you know, it's a team sport. You don't need to have everything, but you know, if you know, you need to, you know, have decent credit. You got to have a little bit of money and you got to have connections, right? So you got to kind of put all these pieces of puzzle together. So if you don't have it, you got to then go find a partner that maybe can kind of fill the gap or what you're lacking. Find someone to come join you to kind of make up for what you're lacking. So none of that starts until you're self-aware and do an analysis, kind of what you have and what you need, and try to solve for the deficiencies within your profile.
Right. That's great. When it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
You know, I don't meditate probably like I should. I don't have a really good morning routine like I should. But you know, one thing, like I said, I try to be pretty self-aware and pretty disciplined when I'm not doing the right task. Always trying to course correct. So that's one thing I try to focus on. The other thing is, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have a lot of friends within the business and industry. So I'm constantly going to different events and spoke at a conference this morning, you know, going to different conferences and trying to talk to people and get their perspective and you know, maybe try to learn a little tip or trick here from, you know, seasoned and very successful people in the industry, because everyone's got a little bit different perspective. And just because I do something doesn't necessarily make it the right thing or the right way to do. And I'm always trying to find different ways of kind of looking at the same problem.
Right. No, that's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Last year was part of when COVID hit, and they had a lot of delinquency within the tenant base, and people were struggling. we gave back, and we gave a rental assistance program that my partner and I kind of put together out of our own pocket and supported a lot of our residents that could apply for. And we'd pay up to 75% of their rent if they could qualify. And so they had to pay something. So we thought of it kind of as a hand up, not a handout, to people that otherwise were good tenants that just needed a little bridge of the gap for a month or two until the government programs finally kicked in 2021. So we did that for the better part of 2020. So I felt pretty good about that. I need to probably find something to as an initiative this year, because that's largely unnecessary at this moment in time. So try to find something else financially. Besides that, I always try to, you know, we do podcasts like yours. We have, I kind of co-host the Old Capital Real Estate Investing Podcast, and try to, you know, give out some advice and lessons learned on how not to dunk away 30 million bucks, but in yield maintenance like I did, by sharing the real, the good, the bad, kind of just sharing, you know, really real life experiences that I had along the way and what I've done well and what I've done bad.
Right. No, this is great. Michael, for listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, two things. I'll give the Old Capital Real Estate Investing Podcast a plug. I co-host that with Paul Peoples. Been doing that for 6 years. You can find that on iTunes or Stitcher or probably anywhere here in my voice right now. Hopefully we're there. So just search up Old Capital Podcast or the website's oldcapitalpodcast.com. And the company I run the other way is PI Advisory. That's a SPI, like spy, advisory.com. If you go there, fill the contact form out. Always happy to send out information about potentially working with us or investing alongside of us. So those are two resources I'll give out.
Wonderful. Michael, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.